Hi, everybody. Hi. Oh, wow, you even said hi back. I wasn't expecting that. That's exciting. So I'm Michelle. I'm here from San Diego, but actually on my way through Monterey and then here. So I'm going to try and have good demos on hardly any sleep. Okay, so wish me luck on that. I'm going to talk about Azure, and I'm going to focus on six decisions that I think are key decisions that are probably part of the core features that most people end up wanting to use and things that I end up discussing with customers. And the discussion actually changes quite frequently because of all the changes in the platform. In fact, one of these discussions just changed as of 2 days ago. So I think it's going to be a little bit interesting to see how you feel about these topics. So I'm with Soliance. I have a consulting business. We wrote a book on Azure for the exam reference, which Magnus was kind enough to actually be our reviewer and critic. He did a very good job, and if you don't like the book, you can blame him. So on that note, let's start with a throwback. So anybody remember the features in Azure as of 3 years ago? Because this was one of my probably not so pretty, but slides around a talk that went through pretty much the whole key parts of the stack. And here we are just 3 years later, and that's probably not even all of it. So there's a lot of features. I'm sure many of you already use Azure because you're interested in being here, so you're probably playing with it or actually putting it into good use. So maybe you've already played with a lot of these features. But obviously, you know, we can't really focus on all of them in an hour, let alone a day, which I did last week, or try to. So what I'm going to do is kind of give you some focus on a certain topology that, you know, unveils the features that seem to be a dilemma point for customers when they start out. So we're going to consider the idea that most people have some sort of maybe web app. They're going to have APIs they call from JavaScript. They're going to have mobile apps possibly calling some other APIs. So we got APIs everywhere because you can't live without them anymore. We might have partner APIs with a gateway. That's another new common thing that has been evolving over the past years, actually. And then we probably have backend APIs, and those are the things that talk to our database. And then even so, we need somebody to be able to log in. So we're going to have identity problems, right? Or hopefully not problems, but identity solutions that allow us to log in and access all of these apps from tier to tier to tier, which means probably, you know, the login step and the dance and then some sort of token flow or authorization all the way down. And then we're going to have things like server processes, maybe asynchronous Windows service type things or cloud-based similar artifacts that talk to also back-end database perhaps that don't actually talk to anything outside the firewall. So these are some aspects that, you know, I usually run into. Obviously, you're going to have queuing mechanisms that tee up jobs or async work, and then you're going to have identity services. So I think that's enough for an hour, and we'll basically focus on how we tease out some decisions around these topics, okay? So with that, 60 minutes or less, because I've already used five, right? For compute, APIs, database technology, async scheduled work, queued messaging technologies, and identity service. Are you ready? Okay, good. So let's talk compute. Now, I need to go relatively fast and yet speak clearly, I realize, because I have a Canadian accent, which nobody understands. So I'll do my best. You let me know if I'm going too fast, yeah? Give me the nod. So we're going to talk about virtual machines. The first thing we think about with compute usually is virtual machines, right? So you need to allocate some sort of VM where you're going to deploy things. And if you're doing IaaS or infrastructure as a service, then this is what you're going to be using in Azure as well, right? So very popular way to deploy topologies where you have full control like you would on-prem, like you would in a colo facility, and like you would if you put it in the cloud in an IaaS environment. So you're creating your VM either through some sort of template in the UI of the portal or downloading those templates or creating ARM templates, which is, you know, the new best way to do that if you're going to be scripting it yourself, and or possibly bringing your own VHD to the party because you have, say, pre-existing appliances that you'd like to get from on-prem, other colo, to the cloud, right? Popular migration is Rackspace to cloud, for example. No offense to Rackspace. Anybody work there? Sorry. So Anyway, so the idea is, we've got to bring our VHDs or we've got to create them somehow, but it's not as simple as that, right? Because you're going to probably need to customize the VHD with whatever it is you need, your special sauce, even before deployment of your software, which means, customizing the OS, maybe locking it down, getting rid of guest accounts, getting some security in place, stopping services that shouldn't be running, whatever the case may be, right? So there's ways to automate all of that. And the life cycle that we usually see, and I'm just sort of giving you a full circle, the things we like to manage, would be things like, first we create the VHD. Okay, fine. So I've got a template that kicks me off. Maybe then I got to attach my disks. So obviously, if you're not going to have just an OS disk, then it's likely I'm going to probably be attaching disks where I'm going to be storing other data as well, file share type things. I'm going to have a system set up, which means what other things I install on the machine, IIS, ADFS, Active Directory topologies, whatever it is that your topology requires, right? Then we're going to do a clone operation. We're probably going to make some specialized version of the image so that we can then deploy that in multiply when we look at an availability set in the cloud. So, we're building sort of our template, possibly interactively, figuring out what that looks like. And if we haven't the time to automate the script for it, then we can at least use that as a clone and an image. And then we start pushing that out as our deployment until it's time to update it. So we push that into a virtual network, most likely, the topology of which maybe might mimic some of the things I show you, but there's variances there. And then we're going to, have to organize it within the context of cloud services so that we get a load balancer in front, possibly availability sets again. And then we're going to look at deploying our actual software, right? Which is another automation step and could have been done before the clone, but realistically, the clone is really the VM image, the operating system, the services. And then, my software is probably going to change because we're going to have bugs to fix. We're going to need to update that. So really, that's a separate life cycle. And that's the life cycle that repeats probably alongside things like patching the OS for, Patch Tuesday security issues and possibly other things that come up like operating system upgrade. And then we've got software updates, which is ours. That's on us. Once we get through all of that, we're probably going to go back to this point where we actually just go and, redeploy our software. So we're basically going through the last three steps, possibly many times. Make sense? So that's a lot of steps, but it's the typical set of steps for IaaS. It's what anybody would do, whether they're in a colo or in the cloud, and that's acceptable. That's fine. Couple things I want to tease out of that because I would like to emphasize, I guess, the difference between, this and when we look at PaaS and some of the evolutions there. So with this, we have to think about our disk topology, right? We're going to get an OS disk as part of the VM, but we need to think about whether or not we're going to be using blob storage for going and getting content, whether our app looks to blob storage or whether our app looks to a file system drive that we'd like to attach. And what does that drive have to look like? So if this is a web front end, I really kind of have some options there. A lot of web front ends do just go to blob storage, and they may not use the file system too much. And that would be fine. But you do have the option. And that would be also a page blob. So it would be equivalent to blob storage, but what I'm saying is not loose content, but actually a drive, right? When we do that and we clone the image and create the specialized version, it'll actually clone also the disk. So we're getting that for free once we've created this topology of a VM with an attached disk and an OS disk. And then we get copies of that when we clone. When we create the disk image and then we push out the availability set of five copies or something like that. Okay? So just something food for thought. We could also go with an SMB approach, right? So, Azure Files. And so now we're looking at SMB access to possibly a shared data disk, which means we're not cloning the attached disk anymore, which is another option. Just showing you some of the things we think about. And then we've got if it's a SQL Server backend, right, which is much more complicated because now we're thinking of probably, high performance IOPS and SSD disks and, going for premium storage features and possibly scaling that out so that we could do up to something like 500 terabytes of storage ultimately if we were to, bring together enough of those disks as part of the solution. So the idea there being, each of these topologies might be slightly different. It's something you have to think about. And it's something you probably already think about if you're used to IaaS. And if you're not, then you're thinking, holy crap, I got to think about that now. So the other thing you got to think about is virtual networks and subnets and cloud services and load balancers and availability sets and the network itself and security groups, network security groups. So looking at that virtual network, we're probably going to do something like put our web servers in a cloud service, which gives us a load balancer. And so that's not to be confused with cloud service, the PaaS offering, right? This is the cloud service that VMs use to essentially allocate the load balancer for the set. And then within that, I'm going to have availability set, which I could have more than one if I wanted to break it up. That just tells it, you know, to keep these machines so that they will not all go down at once. And so they go across several update domains, right? So that Azure knows what to do if a machine is lost and they need to move something to another location, not to move them together and tear you down. So that's a logical thing that is part of VMs that you have to think about as well. And, you know, I'm going to do the same for maybe my backend tier. So I got backend database or backend APIs that I call maybe from the web tier that don't go out to the internet, and then I've got my SQL cluster. So now I've got a three-tiered approach possibly, and those may go in separate subnets so that I can now do network security groups around it. And that's really important because what we want to do is lock down access to the data tier, and we want to lock down access to possibly our backend APIs. And we want to look at the, you know, the front subnet as the one that's accessible to the internet, 8443. Make sense? So far, so good. So the reason I'm taking you through this, again, is to give you sort of the full topology that we might think about, and also including the security aspect. So I said opening up the front end, so it's 8443, and the back two, maybe not so much, right? The key to making this successful, can anybody imagine the one word that we need here? Anyone? Well, there is that. But how do we make all of that go out repeatable process reliably every time? The key is automation. And the thing about automation is everybody says, yeah, we've got this covered. We'll get it all automated. Let's stick with IaaS. It's what we know. We're going to do it. And then what happens when you go live? Oh, crap, you know what? I got to go log into the portal because something's not right, and now I'm going to fix that. And, oh, you know what? I think I need to deploy another one. How do I do PowerShell right now? Shit. And so this is what usually happens. That's the story. Because eventually you're going to automate that, but at the first, people kind of think they can, and it takes about, I don't know, a good 6 months to really put a full-time person on amazing automation for anything you talk about, and even though the tools are great. Make sense? Because the devil's in the details. So why do I say that? Because we want to think about why we choose virtual machines, right? Because it is still work. And maybe some of the reasons would be because we're migrating an existing, you know, brownfield application that's complicated, and we just need to lift and shift. We got to get that thing over to Azure because it's not working well somewhere else, or it's in our colo and it's too expensive, and we're going to actually save money by going under our enterprise, you know, agreement. So we're going to push that up to Azure, and I don't want to change too much because I need to manage this thing the same way I already did, right? Then we've got the concept of complex software. So I know we've all built software before that's a little bit delicate to get working just right. And appliances are a great way to deliver those to customers so that it just kind of works, as opposed to, yeah, run this installer. Oh, you need help again? Oh, okay, I'll send somebody. That's expensive. So that's another good reason to use a virtual machine if you can't get that sort of deployed in another environment like a web app. Maybe it's a pre-existing VM, which is kind of similar to migrating without changes, but it could be actually an appliance VM anyways that you just want to lift up there. And so it's a VHD, boom. And then it could be SQL Server over SQL DB as a choice. Now, that choice is actually kind of going away now, which we'll talk about in another section, meaning the story is becoming so parallel that it's not such an easy thing to say, I think I'd prefer IaaS for SQL Server. We'll talk about that. And then maybe we just prefer IaaS because we've got staff that knows how to do that. That's a reason that's very common, actually. IT pros, how many people know somebody who just, that's what they know, it's what they want to do, yeah? It happens. Nobody in here? Good, because I call that job security. But anyway, they don't need to worry about that because there's plenty of other things they probably haven't got to, like locking down other security aspects, automating some beautiful things that they could have automated, and maybe they can actually just do a better job of automating Azure, which would be great. So just something to think about. So why I choose virtual machines is a good question. It's not to say that's not a good idea. I just want you thinking about, you know, it's work. So let's talk about, you know, whether or not I have other options. So cloud services, I'll talk about only very briefly. This is the original PaaS, right? This is the original set of services that Azure released. Essentially, a project that could produce a web role or a worker role. And if I created, say, a web role, then that would be the equivalent of deploying a VM that had IIS on it, ready to go. Maybe I had an ASP.NET application running in it, and I just published that thing. It took 14 minutes, now it takes 7, and it's headless. So I actually don't go in and set up all the VMs and all the things. I have a configuration that says I have a role, it becomes a VM. And in there, I might also have a worker. That would be the equivalent of a Windows service. And that would become its own VM as well. And I can pick which size I want each of those to be and how many instances they need as well. So that's the idea. Now, I don't know if anybody ever used those because they've been around for a long time. And I still have actually a product on it that I just started migrating over to web apps because the features are there for me to do that now. And there's still a handful of reasons why I still, you know, might choose this. We'll get to that. But there are folks that still, you know, use cloud services as a whole. And so let's just talk about how the life cycle is different from the VHD or the virtual machine life cycle. So virtual machines to cloud service, look at the gray areas. Those are the things I don't have to do when I move to the headless deployment, right? So I don't have to go and create the VHD. It's created for me as part of the deployment. I don't have to attach disks because I don't have all the complex options you might think you need or want. You just don't get to do those things with cloud service. So you get a disk and you get to allocate space on that disk to use, like the temp area or drive, and you get to say how big you need it to be so that you can write files and things. But you're not going in and choosing a bunch of, you know, options around additional disks and topology. You're not going to need to clone the VHD, therefore, right? Because you're just pushing something out. It's a deployment. It becomes a VM out there. I can still do VNets, but I do it in configuration instead of building it in advance, usually. So it's part of the script. And then the patches, I can actually turn that off so that it will automatically patch my operating system and do the updates that are necessary and roll it. Because what happens is, since I'm deploying a package, it can take that package and, you know, it's holding triplicate copies of it somewhere safe. And when it needs to update my VMs or update my topology, my 2-3 instances with a new version of, you know, Windows or an update security patch, it will do that on some new VMs, deploy my stuff, and once those are up and running, get rid of the other ones. So just sort of takes care of that for me, yeah? So it helps me with a lot of things, not quite all of them, but a lot of those. So why would I choose a cloud service right now? I would say because I already have one. So there's no reason to stop using it. It works fine. I have some cloud services that I have running for a really long time now that I don't ever touch. I actually hope I remember where the last version of the source is because it's just been working so well for so long that I just don't know. maybe that's not funny. Who's recording this? It could also be because there's a required feature and you don't want to go to IaaS. So like something that you need that you can't do in PaaS, but you just don't want to go all the way to the VM model so that you have to do all that other work. So you sort of bite the bullet and say, I'll do this hybrid in the middle, and which means I'm using the cloud service environment to run and deploy. A couple nuances that are different with that than you're used to possibly in the dev environment, but nothing that's not worth the value add of not going IaaS, right? So it's a good trade-off. Examples, Dynamic DNS, which we still can't do right now in a website or a web app. So like I want to have, you know, michelle.snapboard.com and magnus.snapboard.com and whatnot, right? So how do I do that? Registry settings, customizing those, I can deploy a startup task and get that done. So I can change things that I couldn't do on a web app, right, VM, which we'll talk about. And then we've got just other miscellaneous customizations that might exist. Like I need to deploy an MSI. But I can do that with cloud service, so I don't have to go full on IaaS to get the results that I'm looking for, right? Okay. And then maybe there's just a worker role need. Well, that's probably a really good reason to continue using them too. So we're going to talk about worker roles and queues and web jobs and some thoughts around when I would go to each. But that's still a pretty strong, you know, I guess, model, if you will, for considering deployment, okay, to a cloud service. So in other words, they're not dead yet. So we thought they put baby in the corner, and baby's not in the corner. We still use it. All right, maybe that was funnier in my head. So app services. So this is the fun one, right? This has evolved in such a big way in the past few years. I used to have arguments with some of my colleagues about, you know, moving customers over to PaaS, the new PaaS, because I was convinced that cloud services was the only way because it's what I knew. And I kind of figured, well, we still don't have SSL and we still don't have all these things. Very, very early days, right, for websites, now web apps. And the truth is, it's just come so far that I ran out of arguments over a year ago, but now, you know, we're really running out of arguments to not look at PaaS. So let's talk about that. What is PaaS in terms of, you know, the new PaaS? It is, you know, you build what's called an app service plan, you select, you know, VM size, and you deploy that on that, any of those four types of services today. So a web app would be the typical choice. You've got mobile apps, which used to be its own thing called mobile services. Now it's called mobile apps, right? We've got Logic Apps, which is the new API app that can do orchestration of other APIs, you know, like communicate between APIs and so forth. You've got API apps, which is just a new way to do APIs. I'm going to talk about that too, though, so hold that thought. So these are four distinct types of things I can push out and deploy that are essentially, you know, internet-facing things that I can reach after I put them on the machine. I can mix them all on one machine. It's totally fine. Or I can allocate them in separate topologies, right? I could have two websites at the front and some API apps at the back and so on. So essentially, this is getting me a VM and saying, put some stuff on it. But my life cycle from the cloud service to that now gets almost all the things gray, because now I'm literally only thinking about my deployment. And that's maybe stating the obvious, right? Most people know that full PaaS means literally full PaaS. I don't have to do all the extra work. It also means I don't get a lot of customization on the machine. I mean, I can edit certain IIS configurations by overriding them in my web config, but I'm not going to have full access to the machine config. I'm not going to have access to the registry. So there's going to be things, I can't deploy just any software, right? I get what's on the box and whatever a NuGet package could add to my project, that kind of thing, right? And that's okay if it's all I need. So that's the ultimate question, isn't it? So our life cycle's gotten reduced significantly. And, you know, what we're really doing when we put together a deployment for app services is we're deciding what app service plan we want, something maybe the standard tier would give me a static IP, and then I choose the VM size that I'm looking for, which also implies what kind of disks am I getting. So I'm still choosing, you know, what kind of premium storage I might want to use and related topics like that, but I'm choosing it, or how much memory I get, how much CPU power it can afford me. I get to choose all of that from my options, but I have to first pick what tier I'm on before I can do that. So there's like a free tier, and then there's, you know, a shared tier, which those two wouldn't be really enterprise as far as I would be concerned. And then you've got standard, where you can do additional options in terms of your own dedicated VM with topologies you need. Okay, so I choose the VM, and then I start putting stuff, deploy websites, whatever it is I want to do. Put my blog on the free tier, and if I get too many hits that month and they shut me off, I'm going to have to figure something out. So why would I choose a web app then? I guess, to me, this is now the default choice. It's more like, why wouldn't I? And that's because if you can save on your time and management and still use your skills to automate deployments and make things really work well, there's lots to automate, right? Like, you know, updating configuration, rolling security keys, you know, things that could go wrong that you have to be able to do. Rebuilding your whole environment because of a disaster recovery need, something, God forbid, goes wrong in some region and you need to fail over, why don't you have traffic manager set up? Oh, we didn't have time. Well, now you do. So you work on these things. You work on a plan to recover, to succeed. So I think it's the default choice until it's not. And, you know, in terms of other requirements that might dictate needing to move away from a web app or a app service plan, it would be that you need more control. So I need to install some sort of registry entry to use this piece of software that I need to generate images. Great. Could that be made async? I wonder if we could just get that over there on a worker role and keep the web app separate from that. Do you really need to deploy that part, that moving part? You know, think microservices. Think, you know, deployable artifacts that have their own life and that have their own environments that they need to run on. So why not take advantage of the web app front end for most of the things, and then stuff that has to require something custom, you pull off and put it somewhere that you can accomplish that. Make sense? Something to think about. And I've encountered that a couple of times where it actually made perfect sense. Let's separate this. Let's put it in a worker. It should be an async thing anyway. And once it finishes processing using these custom, you know, libraries that we need to install, we've now got it updated and the website will just start seeing that data. Everything works. Everybody's happy. Okay. So VM customizations could come up. You could look at an architecture change to make that work. Not as a stretch, but because it makes sense. Not saying you shouldn't ever go IaaS, right? Okay. And now let's talk about app service environments, because this is the real kicker, right? One of the things we cannot do today with app service plan by itself is do a topology where you have a VNet separation between tiers, right? So I get a VNet for free when I create an app service plan, but it's essentially everything's in one subnet, and I don't get to put network security groups on it. I don't get to put, you know, ACLs. I don't get to build a topology of, you know, protected layers behind the firewall, if you will, or create a DMZ. But I can do that if I get an app service environment. So that just means, yes, I have to spend a little more money, but what will end up happening is I get my own front end, which is the load balancer VMs, and those are mine now. It's basically my own mini little colo in Azure. And I'm going to pre-provision my tiers for a certain number of machines, and I'm going to use them as needed to scale out. So I'm pre-allocating. I'm not necessarily paying for everything until I use it, but I'm pre-allocating. And I'm allocating, you know, possibly up to 3 or 4 tiers back here. So the way it works is you create the app service environment, and then you get the front end for free. You don't look at that. You don't configure the firewall at this time. It's just given to you, right, in the front. And then you choose, do you need one worker pool? So don't get confused. The word worker, of course, might feel like worker role. It's not. It's just a pool of resources, VMs, if you will, that need what? The same old app service plan. An app service plan is the equivalent of, I need medium machines times 2 for my front end, or large machines times 5 for my front web end to support the 50,000 people that are hitting the site every morning, you know, whatever that is. So I'm creating a pool for the right VM size, and then I'm going maybe to the worker pool 2 and saying, you know, I've got these web jobs that need to run. It's a small job. It doesn't need a lot of processing power. So let's create a small app service plan. And let's allocate that across 2 boxes to pull from queues and do some processing. Or even just use 1 and scale out on demand. So I get to define these types of topologies. And all of this gets put into a subnet of your choice. So when you create the app service plan, you actually can create the VNet on the fly, but I would say don't do that. Because the likelihood is you're going to want to mix it with some other subnets, which means you need to create the VM VNet first, create your subnets that you'd like to have, or at least the one you want to deploy this thing to, and then deploy to that subnet or create the app service environment within that subnet. So now I've got, you know, load balancer, some things going on in one subnet, and if I want to talk to another subnet, I can. And it can even be an IaaS subnet with a SQL cluster. Or it can even be another set of app service environment with my worker roles or with some backend APIs. So that's the idea. So now I get this topology that I'm creating where I get my subnet, I deploy my app service environment to that, so to that subnet, or I associate it with that. And then all my app service plans go within it. And then when I add another subnet, I can deploy other things to it, like I said. And I can start putting the network security groups in there. So I'll show you that in my second talk. So I won't go into demos on network security groups right now. But you know, how about all that heavy lifting? Do you want to do it, or do you want to look like this guy? Nobody really wants to look like that guy. So, okay, so all that said, I'm not selling PaaS. I'm just trying to make sure you think about the fact that it can do a lot it did not do before. It's pretty cool. So are you willing to spend a little extra money to save on all the operational stuff because you can now have networks and break that thing up with app service environment? It's worth a thought. That's all. Okay, good. Now that I've used quite a bit of time on that particular starting point, let's go into some other details. So these are maybe a little more rapid discussions because they're smaller individually, but equally poignant things that I run into with customers today. And API applications is another important part of this. So when I have an app service plan, I can put out a website, and in my website, I might have some API controllers. So that means I've co-located APIs with web application, MVC, let's say, for example. And that's all good. I might have mobile apps, which is a API targeting really the mobile app, you know, vertical, if you will, that we used to call mobile services. And that also is an API. It's a type of API, right? I could also do, API apps, which is a new capability that's come out, well, within the last, I guess, year in terms of preview and so forth. And API apps are just a wrapper or a gateway put in front of our APIs. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit and why I would or wouldn't use that. And then we'll talk about also API management. And then logic apps is a way to coordinate communication across API apps. Okay? So quickly about API apps, it's based on web apps. So it's the same idea. I've got a VM, app service plan. I'm deploying something that looks like an API controller probably. But what I'm getting with it are some things that I might not have normally had. So I use the template in Visual Studio. I'm going to get some sort of starting point for Swagger support, which would be documentation for my APIs so that other people, even just developers in our company, would have a better chance of knowing what do the APIs do exactly, right? And it also gives you a way to generate client code, which is a really interesting thing because that means, you know, if I want to send over to somebody PHP code to call the API or, you know, based on the definition of my API methods, right, then it automatically generates that from within the API environment. So you can generate code for your API based on the Swagger documentation. Now, you know, whether or not that works for every single scenario, we still have the concept of, hey, pass a string and what goes in that. Just like we used to have to call people back in the day and say, okay, I've got an HTTP endpoint. Yeah, okay, here's that schema I want you to pass because we didn't have SOAP and we didn't have WSDL. And we all know with SOAP and WSDL, it didn't always work perfectly, right? So there's that. But it's a starting point. So there's that. You can publish it to a marketplace and then you can use it with logic apps. So the idea of logic apps is that you can coordinate orchestrations. Take, you know, this Twitter feed, and if you see these tags, then I want you to write those to the data store so that we can do a processing or some sort of machine learning on how people are using that information or how people are tweeting about our products or whatnot. Or, you know, I want you to put this new customer record into Salesforce. Well, there's a little widget for that. So you call this API endpoint, you pass in your customer, you know, contact information, and it goes into Salesforce. So and then you can, I mean, really, there's a whole number. There's probably at least 50 already API apps you can coordinate communication between, including Dropbox and, you know, well-known products like that. And then you can create your own API apps that fit into the mix. It's essentially HTTP in, HTTP out, and chaining, if you like. So there's a gateway created for you when you create an API app. It looks something like this, right? So we have you know, a web gateway, And what that does is essentially become the endpoint for your API. So you're no longer hitting the API that you thought you were deploying, in other words. You get a new endpoint dynamically generated, and then it can scale behind that. You can have multiple APIs actually attached to the gateway as well. So you can have 3, 4, 5 different APIs that you created and attach them to the same gateway because they become part of the same resource group in Azure. So when you create a resource group, the gateway is one per group. What that means is those APIs can talk to each other, even if you lock them down from outside access. So with the gateway, what you can do is go in and control cores. You can control configuration for authentication. I'm going to show you that in a second. And you can control the level of authorization required to get into that API. So you can make it internal only so that it can only be reached from within the resource group. But there's a catch. That means only APIs in the resource group can call it. So there's a practicality issue there because, you know, I've got websites, and what if my website wants to call the API? Can't. So I think there's a better way, but we'll talk about that as well. Let's just take a quick look, though. So I'm going to go to the portal, which I have somewhere here. Ah, reload. And it's working. And we're working, and we're working. And let's go ahead and see if I can search for API. Okay, let's see. Ah, because it moved me over to something else. Let's go here. So this is the preview portal, if you're familiar, probably. It's been preview for a long time, so most people have probably seen it at this point, right? So let's go into here, and let me type API, probably find something that way. And here we go, Boosta App API. So what happens is I had an API, and I'll also show you that over here. And Visual Studio, a very small Visual Studio. Here we go. So let's see if I can make that bigger. Yeah. So you get the idea that, you know, when I created this API app, what it did is it gave me a configuration JSON that I could set up for Swagger, for example. So I can customize what I want the title of that to be, and I can version things. So this is just giving me out of the box right now that if I have a Swagger endpoint and it's going to generate documentation, and I can start putting in information that I want to appear in the docs. So when I run this locally, for example, I can see the Swagger documentation as well. When I publish this, because it's an API app template, it knows it's publishing, you know, the Swagger documentation and so on, because it's all part of the package. But I'm still publishing to a web app service plan, basically. So I'm still choosing where to put it and giving it a name for a slot. So just like a website, right? I'd still have to choose where am I going to put this. This is by design. So if I type Swagger, then it'll take me to the docs. And, you know, it's not very interesting. It's got a test method and a user info method and so on, right? So let's fast forward and go over to the portal and let's see what we've got in here. So I actually have a gateway. So let's see if I can. So this is the gateway URL. And if I click on that, I can actually browse to it. Oops, I think I put that in the wrong spot. Oh, I think I didn't copy the whole thing. Interesting. That might be a little copy-paste error. Let's try that again. Okay. Maybe if you're a fast typer. Oh, look at that. Okay, I think I know what I'm doing wrong. Let's go to the URL. Blonde moment happens. I can blame so many things. Blonde moment, jet lag, Canadian. I'm really lucky that way. So what I can do here is I can go to the gateway and theoretically decide if I want to log in. And I think I've already gone and logged in, so that's why it's saying my API has successfully been created because I browsed and I've already been logged into Twitter. So if I go over to my settings for the gateway, that what we'll see is the authentication settings are available for Twitter. I can add others, but this is what I have set up right now. So I've chosen Twitter as my login method for this API. So that's the thing. You can choose social providers, but there's a catch. I can't just go get a token and post it to this API. And when I think about APIs, I also want to just post a token. I can do that with API management, though. So that's why we want to go to that story, right? This is sort of something in the middle. This was really designed around the mobile services, and it was an acquisition. And mobile services is more about that implicit flow of a user going and getting consent and then coming back to the application logged in. So that works perfectly fine for this type of authentication, if you will. So you go and log in as Twitter, and then you go to the API and you get to see it. So if I go back to the API, I'll be able to see that. And here you can see I can decide whether or not the API should be public or internal and so on. So I'll come back to that in a sec. Let's go over to the actual API itself and sensitive. Okay, so the API is here and API settings let me turn on. Whoop. Wait for it. Here we go. I'm looking for my API settings and my there we go. Okay, I think this is exactly where I wanted to get to. So the fact that I can go to the gateway part, I was showing you the API before. I got a little confused, but the gateway part, you can go and set up whether or not you want cores allowed, and you can set that up separately from your application. So now you don't have to configure all that. Of course, it's not that hard to configure, but that is one of the things that you're capable of doing there. You can also go in here and you can decide if you want to add other providers. So right now, Twitter was the only one that was enabled, but I could come in here and I could say, okay, let's add Facebook. So that means my app needs Facebook application and a relationship with Facebook so that it will do the consent dance for the user, basically. And then the user's still the person logging in at the end of the day, if that makes sense. So again, it implies that the user is in a mobile device or something and they're doing the, implicit flow dance for OAuth2, and then they're going and getting a token from that process and posting it to the API. But I just, yeah. And then you can do it with Active Directory as well. So what I wanted to show you as well is the API management side of things, which works a little bit differently. So just a second here, and we'll find my other API. Let's see here. Okay, so I have this API management implementation. And what it does is slightly different. So it's the same idea. I get a gateway and I get to configure the gateway, but I get to configure the gateway for lots of other things. So for example, I can institute policies, and policies can be for things like licensing groups. This group here could have, you get to call the service 5 times a day. And this group here could get to have unlimited calls or something like that. Those are called products. So I create these products, and then I'm able to associate them with groups of users by giving you a key, like a license key. And the license key is something I can revoke, and then you don't get in anymore if you don't pay your bill or something. So all that management is put together as part of it. But part of the policy also is the authorization piece. So I can say, hey, we're using whatever identity server I'm using. Could be Azure Active Directory, could be some other product that's a SaaS product, but I get tokens from a place, and I'd like to fold my API management story into my token flow story. So now I can go get tokens from my web app and call the API with that token, with that signature, using all standards based, which is why this is sort of an evolution next from the API app story, if you will, because I can do the proper standards to get things done. And I can fold it into my ecosystem as opposed to it only works this way, if that makes sense. Plus, I still get the Swagger, and I get a lot of other features as well. So right now, this took me to the existing portal. And in here, you should be able to see I can go to a developer portal, a publisher portal. I can go and manage the API from here. It takes me to a new interface. It's got a lot of features. Part of those features is analytics and so on. I'll just flip through some pictures for you so we can do it quickly because I still have three other topics to cover. And so if we go in here, I can go to one of my products, like the starter product package for whatever users came in and I gave those licenses to. And in there, it will refresh if it hasn't already. And I'll go full screen here. And what you'll see is I can do things like standards-based, well-known OpenID configuration, which means I can go get metadata for the certificate and dynamically authorize calls based on that trusted cert. Exactly how I want to be able to do it. Thumbs up. See what I mean? Okay. I can also do things like, you know, which token audiences do I trust? I can also do things like what claims am I looking for? So you can start doing additional types of authorization. Why do I care about that? Probably because I do a lot of identity stuff and I like it when it's done in a way that fits with the rest of the story I'm usually building with customers and APIs and backends and front ends and so on, right? So I just really impressed that that actually works. And I can show you that it works because we can go over here and I have a little test link pad environment. Yeah. That basically goes and logs in and gets a token. And when it runs, it gives me the output. But let's say I, you know, say, oh, I put the token in the wrong name here. And what that will do is pretend like I didn't get a token. Then it says unauthorized, you see. Or if I give the wrong license key, meaning it was revoked, then if I run it again, it'll say that it was access denied due to invalid license key. So you get the idea. All that prevention is now done in the API layer, and I didn't have to write all the code. So given how difficult identity is for, you know, most people to pull together, if you could start doing that at a different tier, separate, and if it can follow all the protocols so that I can fold it into my rest of my ecosystem, that starts to look like a pretty compelling direction longer term. Make sense? Okay. I'm glad you said it makes sense, because if you didn't, I don't know what I'd do with myself. So let's go ahead and continue. So the point of that discussion was really a couple of things, right? What should I do with APIs? Should I just deploy them as part of my website? It's getting there. Should I deploy them as part of my website? Or should I put them in an API app? What am I getting for that? Documentation? Use with logic apps. I think right now I would use it if I needed a logic app, and I would use it if I was working with mobile services, mobile apps. So I think those are the two reasons I would use API apps today. I'd rather go to the API management story. Now, the thing about the API management story is there's a lot of features there, and I might not need all of them. So it may need to go through a decoupling before it's ready for everyone to think, hey, I'm going to look at that now. And sort of evaluate if I can use part of the services and not all of them, and if the cost is okay with me, right? So if that makes sense, that's the direction I would look, right? What we do like is the documentation aspect, and what we do like is the token authorization aspect fitting with our ecosystem. But I think if you're doing third-party APIs that you need, say, third parties to build their own mobile apps, their own websites, calling your APIs, and you want to see the throttling and the reports, take a look at what you get, right? So aside from the policies, you get to look at usage patterns, calls, which calls are more popular, how often are they being used, which group of people in what part of the world are using them. And all that's built into the portal right now. You get things like activity for whatever period of days you'd like to look at, so you can get a sense of, you know, peaks and valleys. You can look at individuals' access or part of your licensing group. You can look at, you can actually create like a blog and post information to your partners in the ecosystem. So there's this whole interface, like a CMS for those partners. Not necessarily as fully blown as a CMS would be. Perhaps that will evolve. But the point is there's a lot of different things here. There's also reporting issues. People using your APIs being able to say, I've got a problem, and it actually comes to you in an email and you can respond and track on those issues. So it's almost sounding like a little bit like Salesforce, a little bit. Like a mini Salesforce just for your API management story. So something we're thinking about, but I think at the end of the day, you know, keep in mind that the API app, that's really more, I think, about logic apps and mobile services right now, and that you always want to think about the holistic picture around the identity story when you're folding these other tools in so that you don't become, you know, confused about users and logging in and where they're tied to and so on, right? And how we're issuing tokens for those people. So... okay, so database. SQL Server, this is a shorter discussion only because we're not going to go into every feature of SQL Server and SQL VM, but definitely to propose some of the things that people have fought in the past, I think, between the two sides in terms of not being able to use PaaS, and the fact that that seems to be going away now for lots of reasons. So, I mean, in general, for SQL database, for the PaaS story, we've got many tiers that we can work with. And obviously, the premium tier is the one a lot of people care about the most, right? Because it's how fast can I make it? How many IOPS can I get? I want the best possible performance. And if you can give me that with PaaS and I don't have to manage my cluster and do all kinds of other, you know, ops things, although you're not going to get rid of needing a DBA for some indexing, obviously. Then great, let's go with PaaS. So the PaaS story just didn't have the IOPS before. And now we have it, plus we have other features that we were really, really waiting for customers that are in healthcare and finance, like transparent data encryption. We didn't have that until recently. Being able to do dynamic data masking, huge. Because now you can actually restrict that people can't see, you know, the PII or the PHI that is inside the database, even restricting it to developers if they, you know, happen to be, you know, going into production to try and solve a problem or something like that. They don't get to see the content. And that's a way to put yourself in a good spot checking the box compliance-wise, which I will talk about in my second talk today. So this is really a big thing, the 40,000 IOPS capability with, you know, with SSD drives and being able to get the encryption and data masking and row-level security, all part of PaaS, is huge. And it's removing, you know, the need to go to a VM, theoretically, because we get the high availability, too. We get it with the geo-regional, you know, what is it? You can get up to 4 read-only copies along replicas along with your primary. And that's all managed for you. So that's pretty big. And you can provision those pretty easily in the portal, too. Just go in and check, 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 and now you've provisioned these you know, regional read-only copies, geo-distributed. So you can choose which reasons and go right into the portal to do it. I mean, it's pretty sweet. So this is just worth thinking about. So what are the reasons I've had people say, I can't go to PaaS, right? Sometimes it's a size thing because they get stuck on the idea of 500 gigabytes. But I got to ask you, how many people go past 500 gigabytes that aren't possibly missing the boat on needing to use a big data solution for some parts of their system, which is possible? Because, you know, 500 gigabytes is an awful lot. And, you know, sharding is not necessarily a bad thing if you're getting a benefit on the other side, which is the PaaS story and the ability to have a lot of things managed for you. It's just something to think about. Not everybody's game for that, especially if you have the resources that know how to manage the clusters and you've already got that experience in your pocket. Fine, makes sense. But what about all the people that don't have that? So this is something that, you know, is worth a discussion. The other thing is the idea of how much it was costing for every single, you know, database instance. Well, now we have elastic data pools. So now we have the ability to pool resources and have the multiple instances not pay per instance. And that's huge for people that do multi-tenant applications, that people have multiple copies of a database for another reason. So another interesting evolution, if you will, that gets away from the cost barrier there. The IOPS are there now. The geo-replication is there now. The point-in-time restore up to 35 days is there now. All those things we were waiting for, right? I think the two things that still get in the way is public endpoints. So if I have a requirement that I need to have a firewall or a barrier in front of my database and I need network security groups and a VNet, can't do that right now, right? So in that case, automatic I have to go to VM. There's no other choice, right? The other thing is the SOC type 1 and 2 is not currently proclaimed for PaaS. Now, that only matters if you are a company trying to be SOC type 1, 2 and making statements that that's your, business. Not everybody is SOC type 1, 2. What I find I run into more than that is the HIPAA and the PCI compliance and other certifications and attestations that we actually do have. So that's worth a look too, okay? But again, the number of things just keep going down, reasons that I shouldn't look at PaaS to support it. So I think it's important people are aware of that. Now, Elastic Data Pool, just very briefly, for time, I'm just going to jump right to the pictures because they speak faster. This is huge because I have actual customers that need to isolate their database with instances for tenancy because customers that they serve are not happy with the idea of logical separation by ID. One might argue that you can, tell a good story around logical separation by unique identifier to make sure you get to the right tenant and the right data. But again, some folks just have an idea, this is not what we do. So having the ability to do the data pools is huge because now I can save costs, right? I can allocate a pool. I can put things into the pool, but maybe customer B, C, and Y are actually making use of a lot of IOPS and a lot of space, and I want to push them out. Then I can actually pull them out of the pool. So essentially, in and out of the pool doesn't affect anything. Everything runs as business as usual. And then if they start slowing down and it makes sense to put them in the pool again because I don't want to pay for a unique instance for them anymore, then boom, we put them back in. Make sense? So this is a really nice feature, and you can also do T-SQL across them. So if you haven't looked at that, I feel like that was a nice thing that actually put us in a good position for customers that, again, had the multi-tenancy problem and the costs associated. So. All right, so async work. So what I wanted to talk about here is really just how we handle async work and what the value proposition is of jobs versus worker roles. Because I still use both, but they're for different reasons. But I have a newfound preference, of course, for reasons of simplicity and visual. So web jobs is the relatively new feature, relatively. And web jobs give you the ability to write some C# code, write some Node code, and push out some code that will run against an endpoint. So theoretically, I could call that endpoint securely with a secret from my applications to say, go do this job now. And it will go and spin off and do whatever it's supposed to do. But more often than not, I'm reading a queue and doing some processing. And so the idea is, I might have the scheduler write to a queue, or I might have a scheduler call the web job at its endpoint using the client ID and secret. And this would essentially a great example, backing up storage. So I have jobs that I run for myself, for other customers, that we write for people to back up jobs or back up their storage accounts because it's really fast if you use AZ copy. And any other service just hasn't worked for us. So it's great because you get this visual, all the things that ran, and it's repeatable. If something fails, you can actually replay the job. So you get this list, this history, this log, this output, and you know exactly what happened and when it happened and how long it took, and really, really nice integrated experience in the portal. The other thing we might do is the Azure Scheduler writes to a queue. The web job is listening continuously and pulling from that queue and then deciding what to do. So we use that for the web job. So we have a weekly full backup and then a daily just differential backup. And so what happens is the web job pulls the instruction, and then it writes some other things to the queue that it then processes to separate the different accounts and containers that we want to back up. You can chain these things, right? So it's kind of easy to do. I can continuously pull and look at the queue. And you can actually move the web job into its own VM, which I think makes more sense, just because you don't usually want that running in with your website. So the point that I want to make, I guess, on this one is that, you know, a web job is an async process that can run off a schedule that you could ping to do something or that can constantly pull a queue. And a worker role can do actually the same. The difference is with a worker role, I have to write off my own back off polling when there's nothing in the queue. And I have to write my own rules around if something didn't process, now what do I do with the error? Put it in an error queue usually. And then if it's in the error queue, what am I going to do with that? Well, I need something to look at the error queue, or I need an alert that there's something in the error queue, because in 7 days that queue thing is gone if I'm using Azure queues. So I need to make sure that I'm writing all that code and that I'm looking for my own output and my own UI in front of that output. That's not a lot of work necessarily if it's just an administrative function. It's not for customers. But it's just something to think about. What I like about web jobs is that it can actually automatically do all that for me and give me the history and let me replay the job. What I like about worker role is that it gives me some flexibility. Like I can put custom, you know, code in there. Some of my image processing things require a VM I can customize. So I get the PaaS experience with the headless deployment, and the worker role satisfies that problem. But whenever possible, I actually go to the web job at this point. I just make sure I put it on its own dedicated app service plan so it's a smaller machine and that it scales on its own separately from my website properties and my API properties. Make sense? Okay. And you can put in a VNet behind securely. And then lastly, just comparing the queues, right? So if I'm using worker role with Azure queue, then I'm processing queue, putting it in an error queue. I have to process the error queue. I have to do all that myself. If I move to service bus, then I'm getting the dead letter queue for free. Plus I'm getting a lot of other features, right? Like, well, can look at that. Reliability guarantees, right? Or in order guarantees. Duplicate detection for processing messages. It'll build in throttling. That's the number one thing I think of with Service Bus compared to Azure Queue is the throttling aspect, right? Because then I don't have to write all the multi-threading code to take 10 at a time off the Azure Queue and spin up a thread to go do it in parallel. So I kind of get that for free with Service Bus. And that actually makes my life easier and probably less prone to error. So if you like writing multi-threading code, go for it. But I think it's probably at that point when I need to do really higher throughput processing, I look at the service bus to give me all of that. And then the dead letter queue, of course, I still have to monitor. So it doesn't get me out of that step. It just means part of it's done for me, putting it in dead letter, and it gets persisted there. So it doesn't disappear after 7 days. So there's a durability aspect. So if the message can't be lost, that's better. Make sense? And I mean, just because Event Hubs is so relevant and also is a messaging, you know, platform within Azure, you know, there's distinct differences, right? It doesn't provide reliability guarantees because its whole purpose in life is, you know, just heavy ingest of just, you know, huge amounts of information and large numbers of events and messages, telemetry data at once. And so as such, right, I need a whole different potential topology around that. I might need to do, you know, time series evaluation of data. I might want to reprocess the event hub so it stays in 30 days, all the messages, and eventually I maybe put them through stream analytics and start doing queries on that for the time series evaluation, put them back in another event hub for post-processing, or get them into some sort of, columnar store for machine learning evaluation. So there's all kinds of potential there, but the first step is I can ingest tons and tons of messages and events. And it's really kind of a different model than what we're talking about when we think about queuing and, you know, pub-sub relationships and so on. So I guess that's the comparison. So they're so different, it's kind of easier to detect which one do I want to use, obviously. But when I think about Azure queues and service bus, those two things, you know, Azure queue has a simplicity to it that's sometimes just more attainable for people, and they don't want to deal with all the other stuff and the dead letter queue and everything. But at some point, you have to flip over if you want the reliability and the durability and the throttling. Okay. And then my last message, identity. So it turns out there's a lot of things that might make me drive to an identity service. Password strength, self-registration, email, username recovery, password reset, multi-factor auth, social logins, single sign-on, scale on demand, protection from breach anymore. You know, like really, the list goes on. There's lots of reasons why, in general, an identity service is a really good idea for your app ecosystem. So the scenarios that, you know, we might think of is corporate login to cloud properties, right? So I can use Azure AD for that. I can sync my on-premise AD with Azure Active Directory in the cloud. Works very, very effectively. And then I can log into either on-prem or in cloud with my same credentials from my directory, right? So that's been working for a long time. That's a really strong feature for Azure AD, and it has been one of the more popular reasons to go there. The other thing is I just want a cloud provider. I just want to create users and call and log in. Okay. And then there will be things like multi-factor, which actually just works really nicely also with Azure AD, as well as single sign-on to some 3,000 apps like Salesforce and Bentley Systems, and the list goes on because there's 3,000. So the thing we were waiting for, the thing that, you know, would hold me up from necessarily always being able to say, let's go and use Azure AD, was the social login. And now we have it as of 2 days ago, which is really exciting. So I guess I'm not going to demo because I'm out of time, but I think somebody actually did a talk on that today. Didn't somebody? I think. Yeah. Okay. So good. Thank you for that. So I guess really the main point that I wanted to state there is that this is huge, because now if I'm in Azure, I don't have to look for something else to solve that problem. Which means all the other stuff that's already worked really well, the corporate login and the multi-factor auth and everything, I don't have to give up the social. I don't have to give up the connection of that to my Google and my Facebook and my Twitter and my whatnot. And I get actually a lot more user management features that have come out with this as well, right? And the branding capabilities for the redirect and the login. So it's in preview, but I think that's really exciting, because now we finally can, you know, stay in one place if we want to kind of achieve the goal, and the price is right too. So with that, I think in 60 minutes or more, a little bit more, I covered those topics. I hope that was useful for you. So we'll do security after the next talk, right? And I guess all I can say is thanks. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Cheers.